This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Melinda DeLonge. She covers the Capitol for the Associated Press. We will talk with her about Governor Jindal's fifth year in office, the governor wrapping up his first year of his second term, and much to do as far as the budget for 2014-13. And we will talk with Melinda DeLonge about where the governor is going as far as his ambitions and his vision for the state. Also, David Nassau, his book is The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, the father of the 35th American president, who outlived four of his children, and one of the most prolific people of the 20th century. This today, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And you may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and our guest is Melinda DeLonge. She covers the Capitol for the Associated Press and has done so for the last dozen years. She's been through the reigns of Kathleen Blanco and actually Mike Foster before her, and now Bobby Jindal for 5 years. And as the governor wraps up year one of his second term, we will talk with Melinda about the governor and the state. But first, you are a native of Louisiana, grew up in St. John Parish, right? St. John the Baptist Parish, as they say down on the bayou. And Melinda DeLonge graduated from LSU and the University of Maryland, where you got your MA and you came back home. Now, you're one of the best and brightest who came back. What brought you back to your home state?
Oh, well, thank you for that. Good morning. I went to work in North Carolina for the Associated Press after I got out of grad school. But Louisiana, I always wanted to cover politics, and Louisiana has the most interesting politics of almost any state you can imagine, except maybe Florida. So the lure was pretty strong to come back, and there was a job opening in the Capitol. So I just jumped for it.
And within a year, you were back home. Now, you say Florida has interesting politics. Well, Florida is the third or fourth largest state in America. Louisiana is not. With 4.5 million people, we have about 1.4% of the American population, but we generate far more than 1.4% of the news stories.
Oh, absolutely. And when I was coming back, actually, it was in the time of the second round of Edwin Edwards trials, and Jim Brown, our insurance commissioner at the time, was about to be on trial. So it was definitely an interesting time to come home.
And things are interesting now, and Governor Jindal, to his credit, has kept Louisiana in the national spotlight through his appeal. He is head of the Republican Governor's Conference, and he is a man who, from all indications, looks like he's got his eye on the White House.
There seems to be no doubt about that. If there was any question, I think the question should have been answered when Mitt Romney lost and Governor Jindal was immediately on all the national TV talk shows and not on any of the local newscasts.
That's right. He hasn't done any local interviews, but he's done plenty of national interviews since November 6th. And mind you, that's only 20 days ago. Kevin, do we have a sampling of Governor Jindal with Wolf Blitzer of CNN, immediately tearing into Mitt Romney after the election?
If this is completely unhelpful, this is not where the Republican Party needs to go. Look, if you want voters to like you, the first thing you've got to do is to like them first. And it's certainly not helpful to tell voters that you think their votes were bought. That's certainly not a way to show them that you respect them, you like them. We need to stop talking down to voters. As a Republican Party, we need to fight for 100% of the electorate, not 53%, not 52%, but 100%. We've got to stop trying to divide people into different groups by race, by gender, by class. Instead, we've got to show them that our conservative principles will help them pursue the American dream, enter the middle class, do better. This is completely not helpful. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go. We need to stop being the dumb party. We need to offer smart, conservative, intelligent ideas and policies. That's how we win elections. We don't win elections by insulting voters. Again.
All right. That was Bobby Jindal with Wolf Blitzer. And as you can hear, when the governor gets going. It's hard to stop him, and he can talk incessantly without taking a break. Good breath control from the governor of Louisiana. But what about the words? Do the words have merit?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. He's done a good job thus far of trying to separate himself from a candidate who he spent a lot of time praising and campaigning for only a few weeks ago. But yet he's not actually talking about what he would do. He's saying that the Republican Party needs to stay true to its conservative principles. And he's talked about needing to not be the stupid party and to change the way they talk to voters. But he's not really said yet what he thinks needs to be shifted or what the policies are that he's supporting or what changes he would support in the platform. So it's kind of an interesting walk.
Yeah, it's at this point it is platitudes. He isn't saying what he would do differently. And he says we ought to compete for 100% of the voters. Does that mean everybody? Joe Tragel has formed a group called Louisiana Truth, and he claims, Joe Tragel does, that the governor hasn't competed for every vote in Louisiana.
Well, that is probably true. And obviously, if you're a Democrat, you know that there are certain voters you're not going to attract. And if you're a Republican, you know that there are certain voters who are not going to be interested in your message either. But perhaps it makes a lot of sense to go out there and say we are competing for 100% of the voters as opposed to starting with a certain percentage point and going down from there.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. The guest is Melinda DeLotte from the Associated Press, and we are talking with her about Governor Bobby Jindal, his aspirations, and where the state goes from here. Now, last week, in Melinda's column, the headline in The Advocate says Jindal's relations worsening. What do you mean?
Well, Governor Jindal has not had a great set of relationships with legislators in recent years, and he's not really done much to improve those relationships in at least the last few months. There are a lot of legislators, particularly in the House, who are very angry at the way the governor has handled a series of budget cuts since they left the session. And in that he hasn't consulted with them. He, in a lot of instances, even if the cuts are in their backyard, he hasn't bothered to notify them except maybe an hour or two ahead of time, never more than the day of the cut announcement. And he's also he's clearly spent some time courting people nationally, but he has not spent a lot of time talking to his own legislators, even as he has an agenda that he's trying to push through the legislature. So he's had some difficult relationships with a group of conservative House Republicans who disagree with his budget decisions, and he's also had some problems over some privatization and outsourcing proposals in recent months.
297-5633. Melinda DeLotte of the Associated Press is with us. She's covered the Capitol for a dozen years. Ellen in Sherwood. Ellen, good morning. You're on with Melinda.
Good morning. I think Melinda's incorrect when she says that just Democrats are unhappy with Jindal. I think so many thinking, intelligent, and people who want this country to be a democracy, who want it to stay a democracy, are extremely upset. And in the paper, this article from the Hammond newspaper talked about it. It was a great article in yesterday's paper that said Jindal ran on a campaign for transparency, and he mandated ethics in government, excluding himself and his people. So there can be no transparency when it comes to the governor.
All right. Would you respond, Melinda?
I'm sorry if it sounded as though I was suggesting only Democrats are unhappy with the governor, because that's clearly not true. He's got problems within his own party in this state. There are a lot of Republican legislators in particular who are completely at odds with the governor over a lot of his financial decisions. Beyond that, on the subject of transparency, it's pretty clear that the governor has not necessarily practiced what he preached and what he forced through for some other branches of government and other public servants. He has not necessarily been very open in a lot of the ways that he has dealt with the public.
297-5633 for Melinda DeLotte. Now, as far as transparency goes, the governor is a man who is not a glad hander like many politicians are. You don't see him. We don't see him out and about that much in the city, as his predecessors have been. But what do we know about him? Do we know what kind of books he likes, what kind of movies he goes to, if he does at all, what kind of friends he has, who are his confidants? Do we know any of this?
We know a little bit of it. It seems as though his closest friends and his confidants, by his own telling of it, are his wife, Supriya, and his chief political advisor, Timmy Tipple. Those seem to be the two closest people to him. And we've asked him before about movies that he's seen, it's usually children's movies that he's seen with his kids and those kind of things. So, I mean, he seems to be very focused on his work and his political aspirations, and there's not a lot of there doesn't seem to be a big circle of friends or advisors outside of his core group.
Does he have any hobbies?
He every so often he'll talk about watching football games. He'll talk about watching some TV shows, watching movies with his kids and hanging out with his children.
Football games. But he doesn't go to the LSU games.
No, he doesn't. But I am a very large football fan. And whenever I encounter the governor, he does seem to keep up on what happens at the LSU games because he does talk about football.
You think he could name the starters on offense and defense? I bet John McKithen could have in his day.
I'm sure that Governor Jindal could probably do that, whether it's from dutifully watching all of the games or at least reading the paper to make sure you're following it.
And if he were preparing for an interview, I bet he would be able to memorize the 22 names without much difficulty. He's a smart guy.
He's a very smart guy. There's no question about that. You can't move as seamlessly through from higher education to healthcare. Those are two very big areas of state government with a lot of complex issues. You can't move and be in charge of entities within that and not be a very smart guy.
877-217-5757, wherever you may be, and inkstershow@wrkf.org. Steve Wynum, former budget director under Governor Romer, has written a comment saying, unlike his predecessors, the governor can get away with little negative consequence as far as not doing local media interviews. The public apparently has become inured to it and accepts it as okay. And since he is successfully creating and burnishing a somewhat mythical image in the national media, writes Steve, why should he risk directly exposing himself to potentially negative reportage on the local level? After all, the national media might begin to take the local media seriously if there were too many negative reports.
Well, there is a school of thought, obviously, that perhaps they're not regularly submitting to interviews with the local media because we would have more specific questions to ask him than just seeking platitudes about the future of the Republican Party. But that being said, any candidate, when he or she gets to the national stage, if he or she is actually running for office, the national reporters will go back and look at what local reporters have written over the years. They will talk to local reporters about what has happened. I mean, I don't think that the things we write and say here go into a vacuum. It may not appear that anything that we have written has caught on or caught attention on the national level yet, but when a candidate gets to be a presidential candidate, the level of scrutiny that is given to that candidate is going to be pretty significant, and a basic LexisNexis search or Google search will pull up a lot of the criticism or just a lot of the commentary that's gone on about the governor locally.
We will talk with Melinda in our next segment about the budget and as far as the governor's philosophy. He has stayed true to his word. He's not a person who will embrace new taxes, at least under the name taxes. Has this caused him some difficulty as far as crunching the numbers and balancing the budget?
I don't know that I'm sure it would be nice to have additional revenue to plug budget holes if that's what you're looking to do. But if you're looking to deal with an image of being a conservative who never raises taxes, and if you're looking to show that you're shrinking the size of government and following that political philosophy, then the approach he's taking is obviously going to be one that follows that. It just makes things a little more difficult in terms of crafting a budget.
297-5633. We will return with Melinda DeLotte and the phones after this one-minute pause.
At the Diane Rehm Show, you get answers to questions you ask. We offer lively and civil discussion of topics that matter to you. Satisfy your curiosity, hear what experts and newsmakers have to say, and then tell us what you think. The Diane Rehm Show. Join us weekdays.
Brought to you by Brian Harris, BMW Mini.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on 89.3 WRKF.
Support for the Jim Inkster Show provided by Luba Workers' Comp. For over 20 years, Luba has provided workers' compensation coverage to businesses throughout Louisiana and now Arkansas and Mississippi. LubaWC.com. Luba Workers' Comp. Genuine dependability.
And by LSU School of Music a cappella choir's Candlelight Service, featuring medieval works and traditional carols with audience singing accompanied by LSU's brass consort. Union Theater, Sunday, December 2nd, 7:30. Music.lsu.edu.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and Melinda DeLotte of the Associated Press. She covers the Capitol and has done so for the last three administrations, Foster, Blanco, and Jindal. And she is here to talk about Governor Jindal and anything else that you have in mind locally. 297-5633 is your number. Now, as far as comparing the three governors you have covered in Louisiana, some stark differences.
They all have vastly different styles. They're all interesting in their own ways, but Governor Jindal is obviously very regimented and structured in the way he deals with the media and with people in general, and that's a stark contrast, particularly from Mike Foster. Governor Foster was much more of a say what's on your mind and just shoot straight from the hip kind of governor. And they all have different styles. They all had different priorities in the way that they dealt with issues in office. So,
now, in the past, with Romer and Edwards and Treen and McKithen, they would come out and talk for 30 minutes, and people could ask anything on their minds. This governor, it's basically the topic of the day, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And his handlers like to ask you, if you attend a press conference or any kind of event that the governor's having, his communication staff likes to ask you ahead of time if you have any questions that are off the subject matter. And they like to try and find out what they are. We don't necessarily always comply with that, but that is what they try to do. They limit the number of questions he'll take in a given setting.
What if somebody just out of the blue asked him about the exorcism?
I suspect that he would be able to answer it in a way that doesn't necessarily get at the heart of the question, but gives you an answer. He's very good at always being able to say something and not looking surprised or caught off guard by a question. He's very disciplined. I mean, he's better at not answering a question than almost any politician I've ever seen while talking to you.
Steve in Glen Oak. Steve, you're on the air. Good morning to you. You're on with Melinda DeLotte. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Ms. Melinda DeLotte and Jim Easter. How y'all doing this morning? Okay, look, I'm in shock and dismay about general criticism of Mitt Romney. When he's running a dictator type of government, and also he just got rid of the tobacco tax, something that we really need in the state of Louisiana. He got his state representatives and senators afraid of him because if somebody disagreed with him, he'd get rid of him. I'd like to get my opinion on that off there, I mean.
Well, she's on the air right now, Steve, but what about the statements? And Steve's not alone, saying this governor is more like Huey Long than Mike Foster.
I think the term dictator is a bit strong, but setting that label aside, I would say, I mean, the governor and his advisors have clearly realized that the legislature in this mm-hmm. state doesn't necessarily function like an independent branch of government and often does what it's told and has traditionally for years. And this governor has used that to his advantage. And if legislators really wanted to, they have the ability to act as an independent branch of government and to disagree and to respond. And they, with a few exceptions, have largely chosen not to do so. And so that gives the governor a tremendous amount of power.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Dorothy, you're on the air with Melinda DeLotte. Hi, Dorothy.
I wondered if you find a certain level of hypocrisy in the way he talks about with Will Blitzer about speaking to the voters like they're dumb, but he treats the voters of Louisiana like they are dumb.
Does the governor treat the voters in his state with contempt?
I think that's probably a strong statement, and people here have reelected him, and they reelected him with a pretty healthy margin. No one else was able to challenge him in any real sense. The Democratic Party couldn't field a candidate that was well funded. So clearly, voters here have favored the governor, and at least some ways believe he's doing a good job. And I don't know that people would vote for someone to be reelected if they felt he was condescending and patronizing to them.
297-5633, Melinda DeLotte with us for a bit longer, and she surveys the Capitol and knows the governor as far as his public persona about as well as anybody on the scene these days. And the governor did win reelection going away, a landslide, but the turnout was low. He received fewer than 700,000 votes. And to put that in perspective, last week, President Obama lost in a landslide last week, 3 weeks ago, lost in a landslide in Louisiana, got just under 41% of the votes, but he got 808,000 votes, over 100,000 more votes than Governor Jindal received a year ago. Does that mean Barack Obama is more popular than Bobby Jindal in Louisiana?
I believe that means that more people turn out for presidential elections, probably, than they do for a governor's race. I mean, obviously, if people had a serious problem with Governor Jindal, or if there had been a lot of vocal opposition to him, or if his approval ratings had dipped significantly, then there would have been a stronger challenger or opponent, and there wasn't. So I think a lot of people maybe stayed home because they knew what the outcome of that race was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, that said, people do turn out in heavier numbers for presidential elections, but Governor Edwards, on at least two occasions, received more than 1 million votes in a statewide race for governor. Mike Foster got over 900,000 once, and Bobby Jindal's yet to crack 700,000. So something is going on as far as the energy is not there, even though the victories have been obvious in his races the last two times out. But some would say against very weak fields.
Well, I like to say that as someone who has grown up in Louisiana, I think people in Louisiana have fairly low expectations for their politicians. And as long as they feel that they're not being cheated or stolen from, perhaps they continue to reelect people that they may not feel that one way or the other, but they don't actually challenge them.
Well, it was Buddy Romer who said, we're going to make the world stop laughing and start listening. And the national media are listening to Governor Jindal. And as much, Melinda, as his speech in 2009 was deadpanned by national media, he's still there. He's still a player. And he looks like he's running for president for 2016.
Oh, he's absolutely considered a player and someone of national prominence. I mean, he's on TV a lot, and he's willing to do those kind of national pundit type interviews and discuss the national political scene at a time a lot of people mm-hmm. are not necessarily as interested in doing that immediately. So mm-hmm. that gets him a lot of attention, but he's a strong performer on the national stage. I mean, he knows his talking points. He's a very smooth campaigner, and he obviously is a very strong conservative voice.
Okay. Jeff on Acadian wants to know if the governor spends a lot of time at the gym.
I believe he said that he works out fairly early in the morning, like on a treadmill or something, reading the newspaper. But I'm not sure if that's at the mansion.
Pumping a lot of iron, maybe. Here's one from Swede White. He says, Governor Jindal is a tyrant. He rules by the mantra of might is right. I hope the people of this country look at his track record in Louisiana, especially higher education, before considering him for national office. Now, that is an issue that is relevant. He is not particularly well-liked in the university communities, not only in Baton Rouge, but in other parts of the state because of budget cuts. Is that something that will have relevance both in Louisiana and if he seeks the White House?
Oh, absolutely, I think it will. I mean, it obviously, if you want to be a knowledge-driven state and if you want to talk about the need for college education and people to get higher levels of degrees, making $420 million in cuts in state financing to the higher education system is probably not going to necessarily dovetail with that perspective. But that being said, his approval ratings in Louisiana remained very high even as he was making those kinds of cuts, the cuts that seem to have actually affected the way people view him tend to be more about the healthcare cuts and the cuts to the charity hospital system. That seems to be
everybody, yeah.
Right. People seem to understand more when their healthcare services are being cut than they pay attention necessarily to the college level cuts.
Shannon in Springfield. Shannon, you're on the air with Melinda DeLotte. Hi, Shannon.
Hey, Jim. Anybody that's going to hold public office, one of the first questions people want to know is what's their basic character? And it's little things come through that can show a lot. And I don't remember the guest you had, but somebody came on there and talked, gutted the ethics board or took their teeth away completely. And I thought that was a pretty revealing incident.
Well, and the moves you're talking about regarding the ethics board are curious, considering that the governor in his first inaugural address on the 14th of January, 2008, he said that ethics would be his primary focus. Some would say ethics for some, but not for everybody. And the ethics board is pretty much a toothless tiger now. Would you agree with that assessment, Melinda?
Well, a lot of their authority to actually rule on cases and their power to actually make determinations about ethics violations was taken away from them and moved to a different board of administrative law judges. But those ALJs are ruling on cases and they're actually, you know, moving forward with various prosecutions and they are making decisions. I think it'll be a while before we get a full sense of what the changes really mean. But yes, they did take complete authority away from the ethics board to rule.
And the governor talked about the gold standard for ethics in his first inaugural. That was his major focus. Shannon, did you have a follow-up? Apparently not. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on with Melinda. Good morning, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. Another great subject and hope to see you on TV one day. Question to your guest. We have one of the most strongest governors in the nation, has a lot of power. Do you ever see the legislator reducing some of that power to, you know, share it more? And with the way the governor kind of not, you know, kind of controls his audience, do you see him being able to exist like that on a national level if he was to become president?
Well, interestingly enough, I recall, I think it was Wayne Parent's book, Inside the Carnival. He had a chart that looked at the constitutional and statutory powers of governors. Louisiana's governor is actually somewhere in the middle of the pack. What gives our governor so much authority is the fact that the legislature seems to cede so much of its own authority to the governor, and they let the governor choose who is the House Speaker and who is the Senate President and choose who are the committee chairmen. So until the legislature decides to change that tradition and that history, it doesn't seem as though the governor in Louisiana is going to lose a lot of authority. Now, I think it would be a rude awakening for anyone to go from that level of power to a more democratic form of government in Congress and in Washington. That's probably going to be a big shift.
Thank you, Paul. Lynn in Melrose. Hi, Lynn. You're on with Melinda.
Good morning, Jim and Melinda. It's nice to talk to a fellow University of Maryland alumnus. I go back along before you. I'm curious. I admire what you've been saying, but you keep reinforcing this idea that Bobby Jindal is so brilliant. I've worked for five governors, including Jindal for 9 months, although I must say I'd never had any real direct interaction with him, but I don't see the evidence for that. I think he's brilliant at memorizing sound bites and details. Like after Isaac, he told the press that there were 495 school buses mobilized or something like that. But, I mean, that's not the kind of intelligence that I think we need. But my question is, what do you think, assuming that he is running for president in 2016, what kind of possible message can he send, having been the governor of a state for 5 years that is still at the bottom of just about every list we know of?
I think that's always going to be a difficult difficult issue for him to get past. I mean, he's going to be in a state that is among the poorest in the nation, that's at the bottom of so many lists, and his task, if he really wants to move forward on a national stage, is obviously going to be trying to show that Louisiana has made improvements on some of those benchmarks in education and healthcare and economic development and in this quality of life here as he goes forward. Now, whether he can do that is a completely different question, because you are correct. Louisiana on paper does not exactly look like it has made leaps and bounds under the Jindal administration.
Alex in Broadmoor writes that while the national murder rate has gone down over the last several years, it has risen exponentially in Louisiana. Why doesn't the governor address this?
Perhaps because that's a very politically tricky issue. It's a very murky subject, and it's not something that's easy to check off a list. I mean, there are going to be that's a very difficult topic to deal with, whereas, you know, adding one more law on the books that deals with sex offender crimes is probably far easier to check off on a list when you're trying to sell yourself nationally.
There is carnage on the streets, particularly in New Orleans and in Baton Rouge, and I have yet to hear the governor in 5 years address the murder rate in either city.
I don't think that I have heard him talk about that much either. I know at some point one of the New Orleans legislators was trying to get some traction on an issue about having the National Guard help out in New Orleans, and the governor didn't really want to talk about that topic and had no interest in that legislation. But I don't recall him really having a lot of discussions or initiatives about crime overall and the murder rate.
Well, the governor is perfectly comfortable going to churches in North Louisiana and spreading his mission or his message of evangelical Christianity. But does he go into neighborhoods that are wrought with crime? Have we seen him in Scotlandville? Have we seen him on 22nd Street in Baton Rouge, not far from where he lives?
Not as far as I have ever seen, but those aren't necessarily his voters either.
Well, he's competing for every vote, isn't he?
And as you mentioned, he did go to churches across North Louisiana for quite a while, but that seems to have slacked off a little bit since the election is over.
Well, there is no future election for him, at least in the near term. But the question now is who succeeds him? And we're 3 years out, and we're already speculating about that. And it looks like, just as the governor is ramping up to run for president of the United States in 2016, Senator David Vitter is gearing up to run for governor of Louisiana.
Oh, I think I've heard probably a dozen different names of people who are interested in running, and why not keep your name out there right now just to see what kind of traction you get? Senator Vitter obviously hasn't commented one way or the other on interested in running, but he has definitely not squelched the idea. But as you know, and anybody else who watches politics, that doesn't necessarily mean somebody ends up running down the road. It just may mean that they like having their name out there.
Well, the senator has made numerous appearances in the state and has done so in many cases under radar. He has stated that he will visit all 64 parishes and have a town hall meeting in each one, I believe, during this term. And he's stayed true to his word. The other day, he was spotted in Starbucks on College meeting with Jeff Hughes, a candidate for the Louisiana Supreme Court. He's certainly not afraid to immerse himself in Louisiana politics.
Oh, absolutely not. And he has not been afraid to disagree very strongly and openly with Governor Jindal when he doesn't think that the governor has taken the appropriate path on certain issues. So he has definitely become more prominent in terms of discussing state politics as opposed to just national politics.
Finally, as far as the biggest challenge the governor has regarding the budget, you write about it in today's Advocate. What's the biggest obstacle right now?
Well, he's going to run into some of the same problems that he ran into last year, which is there is a growing organized group of fiscal conservatives in the House who disagree with the use of one-time money and kind of piecemeal and patchwork funding to pay for ongoing expenses. And that's going to be the budget battle of this session again.
Well, Melinda DeLotte, good to visit with you, and hopefully we can coax you into coming back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be back with David Nassau. His book is The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy.
Thanks for joining us on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, your news, your culture. Listen live on your computer at WRKF.org.
Support for WRKF provided by our members and by the LSU Foundation, helping alumni and friends advance academic excellence through private financial support for LSU, the LSU Ag Center, the LSU Law Center, and the LSU System Office, lsufoundation.org. And by Taylor Clark Gallery, specializing in fine art, Audubon prints, and handmade custom framing for holiday gift giving. Taylor Clark Gallery, 2623 Government Street in Mid-City, and taylorclark.com. And by River Road Coffees, blended, roasted, and packaged each week in its hometown of Baton Rouge. River Road Coffees, precision-roasted coffees delivered to offices and available at stores and online at riverroadcoffees.com.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. David Nassau is our guest. He is the Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. Professor of History at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, a noted biographer. His targets in the past have included Andrew Carnegie and William Randolph Hearst, and now he is back with a remarkable opus about a remarkable man, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, a book that is almost 900 pages in length, and I'm sure you left much on the cutting room floor. He had a full life in his 81 years on the planet, David.
He certainly did.
A very complex life, too. There are those who say, first of all, they say he was a bootlegger. Is that accurate?
No, that's not accurate. I wish it were, because I could have written about a lot of interesting characters, you know, Momo Giancana and Bonanno and Capone and everybody else. He wasn't. He wasn't at all. As a matter of fact, the stories of his bootlegging only appear really in the 1970s, the late 60s. When his son ran for the presidency in 1960, Richard Nixon had squads of researchers trying to dig up dirt. They found lots of dirt, but nothing about bootlegging. During his life, Kennedy was investigated by the FBI because he was up for important appointments in Washington in the government on 5, 6, 7 occasions, and nobody ever mentioned the bootlegging. Only in the 70s did all these people come out of the closets, people we don't generally regard as being terribly trustworthy, like Joe Bonanno and Meyer Lansky and Al Capone's piano tuner and Tina Sinatra, with third-hand stories about how they saw or they heard, or Joseph Kennedy, you know, making deals or hauling liquor off the beaches in Cape Cod. When you track down each of these stories, they vanish into thin air. You know, they were stories with no basis in reality at all.
Well, his life made him an important figure in the 20th century like few others. In fact, maybe as far as non-presidents go, he might have been the most important figure. He was both a friend and an enemy of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Those two had a relationship that is captured in your book.
It was one of the joys of writing this book, is to write about these two titans, these two men who were unbelievably charismatic, who could charm, you know, anybody in a room into admiring them. And their relationship was never an easy one. They liked each other personally. They worked together. They needed one another. Roosevelt needed Kennedy because he needed a strong Irish Catholic American on his side when he ran for election in 32, 36, and then 40 and 44. Kennedy needed Roosevelt because Kennedy wanted to go to Washington. he wanted an appointment in Washington, and then he wanted to be ambassador to Great Britain. And only the president could make that happen.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation with David Nassau, one of the primary historians of contemporary figures in American life, and his latest target is Joseph P. Kennedy, the patriarch. Now, Joseph Kennedy was the first head of the Security and Exchange Commission, and he was certainly vital during the Roosevelt years, but when it came to the war, the World War, World War II, he was not an advocate of going to war against Adolf Hitler, was he?
No, he made two dreadful errors, and he was overtaken by fear in a way that clouded his judgment and destroyed his reasoning powers, really. He was so fearful that if the United States, which was barely out of the Depression, went into war or began sending resources to Britain to fight the war, Depression would return. And this time it would be worse than ever, and the result would be the end of capitalism as he knew it, and he thought the end of democracy. You know, democracy was rather fragile in the late 1930s. The United States and Britain were near alone. Italy, Germany, the Soviet Union, most of Eastern Europe, Japan, these were countries that were run by dictatorships. And Kennedy feared that that was the path that the United States was headed towards. So he believed anything was better than war. And he also believed, and this is his second outrageous error, he believed that Hitler could be bargained with, that it was possible to make a deal with this man. Kennedy, in fact, tried to get to Berlin to talk to Hitler because he thought he could, sitting down at a table with Hitler, businessman to businessman, make a deal to keep the peace.
But yet, he lost one son to the war, and he almost lost another.
It was one of the great ironies of his life, and he never ceased to repeat it, that he had done everything he possibly could to keep the country out of war. The war had come, and it had taken away his oldest son, and he thought crippled his second son, Jack John Fitzgerald Kennedy, for life. John Fitzgerald Kennedy returned from the South Pacific, a frighteningly frail, sick man with malaria, a bad back, a bad stomach. One of the reasons why Kennedy never believed his son Jack would succeed in politics was that he never believed he'd live to be 30, much less 35, and run for the presidency.
Well, Jack Kennedy acted heroically in the PT-109 episode, and you write, David Nassau, that when that occurred, the future president was missing, and Joseph P. Kennedy knew about it and didn't even tell his wife.
It was an extraordinary story. Joe Kennedy had his spies everywhere. He knew what was going on all over the country and certainly with his children. Jack Kennedy's was on a PT boat, and that was classified. But he heard, Joe, his father, heard from friends in Washington that Jack was missing. His PT boat had gone missing. And for 2-3 days, he kept to himself. He didn't tell anybody about his fears. And then on the third day, he heard on the radio, of all places, that his son had been found and had been rescued. He breathed a sigh of relief, but I guess like all fathers, continued to worry that his son was too frail to endure and survive the trials he had been through when his boat sank.
You note in the book that in 1945, Joe Kennedy was 57 years old. He had had great success in Hollywood and in Washington. He was a fabulously handsome man, like his sons after him. And yet he was a broken man because he never really recovered from the death of Joe Jr.
He never did. He never recovered from the death of Joe Jr., and then things got worse. In 1948, his favorite daughter, Kathleen, or Kick, who had lost her husband during the war, was killed in a plane crash. In his eldest daughter, Rosemary, who was retarded, had a lobotomy, which he had arranged for her, because he thought it would make her more comfortable, less angry, less depressed, less anxious. And the lobotomy went wrong, and she was turned into a vegetable. So three of his children were dead, and he still believed Jack would not survive into, you know, young adulthood. And he blamed the war. He blamed the war for all of this. He blamed the government in Washington for not listening to him and for fighting a war it could not win, he thought.
He was a type A personality with steroids, right?
Yeah. He was, his work rhythms were, you know, he would work himself into a state of physical and nervous exhaustion when he was on a task, whether it was selling stocks and buying stocks or producing films in Hollywood or serving as the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission related to the Maritime Commission. He'd work 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day, and would do that as long as he could, and then literally collapse. The only way he kept himself going was by taking long vacations at his home in Palm Beach, and nothing, not the birth of a child, not a deal in Washington, not a call from the president, would get him out of Palm Beach during that winter vacation, because he knew it was the only way to survive.
He had a well-publicized affair with Gloria Swanson. Was he a womanizer?
He was certainly a womanizer. He believed that to be a good father and husband, one provided for one's family, one took care of one's family financially, but that didn't mean being faithful to one's wife. As you didn't embarrass your wife, you could lead a separate life. And he did. There were many, many women in his life. Gloria Swanson, Claire Booth Luce, many women who were famous and not famous. And that was, he thought, acceptable as long as he didn't embarrass Rose.
Hundreds of women.
I didn't try to keep count, but many, many, many.
The book is The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, who was born in 1888, a year before Adolf Hitler. In 1945, the war ends, and Joseph P. Kennedy is scarred by that war, but his son, John Kennedy, the wounded warrior from World War II, ends up being president of the United States at the age of 43. How much did the father have to do with that?
The father had very much to do with the early candidacies. In 1946, Jack Kennedy runs for congressman for the first time. 52, he's elected to the Senate. 58, he's reelected. Kennedy, the father, taught all of his children to be comfortable in front of the newsreel cameras. He taught them how to be public figures, how to appear in public. He taught his son, Jack, how to appear on television. It is no accident that in 1960, during the first debate, Jack Kennedy looked absolutely comfortable, at home and at ease, talking to the American public through a television camera. Richard Nixon, the great debater, looked ill at ease. He didn't know how to approach the camera. It was Joseph Kennedy who had taught his son how to appear on camera. He bankrolled all the campaigns. He was the major advisor through the 58 campaign. By 1960, Jack had assembled his own campaign staff Jack was a man who understood politics as well as his father did. And in the presidential campaign, Joe Kennedy supplied all of the money, but was less a factor than he had been earlier.
Well, Joe Kennedy had a massive stroke in 1961, the year his son took the oath of office, and he held on for 8 years. But during those 8 years, John Kennedy's assassinated, Robert Kennedy's assassinated, and Ted Kennedy disgraces the family with his actions at Chappaquiddick. In many ways, he died a broken man, didn't he?
The last chapter of the book was by far the most difficult to write. The suffering of this man was unimaginable. Whatever, you know, sins he had committed, whatever mistakes he had made, no one deserved his fate. In December 1961, 6 months into his son's presidency, he suffered a massive stroke. He became, from being this handsome, debonair man, a crippled shell of a man. He couldn't walk. He could not use language. He couldn't speak. He couldn't write. He couldn't communicate in any way other than by saying no. And he would say no, 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 shouting it until his wishes were met. And then he'd say no in a gentle, quiet way. And by looking at his eyes, one could tell that he meant yes. He was unable to speak when his son Ted and his daughter Eunice came into his room at Hyannisport to tell him that his son, the president, had been assassinated. And then a few years later, the unimaginable happened, and his third son, Robert, was assassinated. No father should have to live through the death of four of his children before they reach, the prime of life. But Joseph Kennedy did.
One of the reviews of your book says, in the end, Kennedy's suspicion that the cosmic deck was stacked against him was tragically validated. He was a pessimist, and unfortunately for him, his pessimism was evidenced in his life.
Yeah. At every step, with his children, he was an optimist. He would always tell them, oh, everything's going to be fine. Privately, he worried. Having made his millions of dollars and secured a future for the family, he was convinced that something would happen and it would be taken away, that depression would return, that the Cold War would become hot war, that more his fortune would be lost, and that democracy would be imperiled.
It's an amazing book from historian and biographer David Nassau, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. Thank you, David. Good to visit with you, Professor, and it is 800 and some odd pages of 858, I believe, of chock full information about Joe Kennedy and the Kennedy family. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.